And by the way, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says that we are a very critical people, and this is the source of our wisdom, and it's not foolishness. And he is going to say that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Jewish people, they didn't immediately accept him and say, "Praise be the Lord, the Messiah has come." They put Moshe Rabbeinu through his tests. What did I want to say? That's right. How did you know I wanted to say that? Somebody came to me recently and he says he has Ruach HaKodesh. The Divine Spirit has told him all sorts of privy information, and he was sharing some of this information with me. So I told him, I don't believe you have the Divine Spirit dwelling and resting upon you. He was slightly taken aback, to say the very least. I was afraid, of course, that I'm taking my life into my own hands because of this. But I said no, and I said that as a good Jew, I refuse to believe that you have the Divine Spirit that speaketh from your midst. I don't believe it. And I quoted to him the Rav Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzri, where we're up to right now, where Rav Yehuda Halevi says that Jews did not accept the claims of Moshe Rabbeinu without him proving to them that he is indeed the messenger of God. And he says the famous statement, "Lo me sichlutam," not because of their foolishness, "Elo me chochmatam," it was from their wisdom. Jews traditionally have not been a gullible people. Until the present time, things may be different now, but I got that one statement out of the way. They weren't gullible people. You couldn't simply come to the Jewish people and say, "So Seth saith the Lord." What do you mean, "So saith the Lord"? How do I know that what you're saying is indeed the word of the Lord? If you'll take a look into 48, an arrangement of this kind removes any suspicion of untruth or common plot. We'll get you a text right away. My executive secretary isn't here. I'm reading from the text. Anyway, not 10 people could discuss such a thing without disagreeing and disclosing their secret understanding. He's talking. Baylor, do we have a text? The king over here is saying that everything that appears in Torah has to be historically true. It can't be a plot that people decided on in advance. They decided in advance that we're going to tell people that there were 10 plagues and Jews went out of Egypt miraculously. And they're going to tell people that 3 million stood at the foothills of Mount Sinai and God himself descended from the mountain to the top of the mountain and spoke to them. You could never get 10 people who could discuss such a thing without disagreeing and disclosing their secret understanding, nor could they refute anyone who tried to establish the truth of a matter like this. How is it possible with such a mass of people is concerned? By the way, one of those sheets that I gave you today, the one that's in English, today's English handout, I just happened to notice it earlier this morning. By the way, this is taken from the footnotes in a book called The Faith of Judaism by Isidore Epstein. Isidore Epstein's book, The Faith of Judaism. If you have a chance, it's in paperback. Jews College, yes, the English are all full of pride now, yes. He's very good. And he has over there on page 132 what's underlined, and we're going to need another few quotes from here. He quotes from Rav Sadia Gaon, who really makes the same claim of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The fact that no other religion ventured to make such a claim is the best guarantee of the validity of Israel's claim regarding the Sinaitic revelation. If you could pull off a hoax and say that there were 3 million people standing at the foothills of Mount Sinai when God descended upon the mountain and spoke unto them and said, I am God, your God. If you can pull off such a hoax, I mean, it's not a bad sounding hoax. Pretty good. We're able to pull it off. 3 million people were at the foothills of Sinai and heard God speak. So if Sadduce Goyen says, the fact that no other people ever made any claim even similar to it is proof positive that you can't get away with a statement of this sort if it's not true. And that's why I said Christianity never claimed that there were many people present at the resurrection of Yeshua, because they couldn't make that claim. So read again, Rav Sadia Gaon. The fact that no other religion ventured to make such a claim is the best guarantee of the validity of Israel's claim regarding the Sinaitic revelation. So here we have precisely the same idea as being expressed by Rav Yehuda HaLevi. Now, watch this. 49. The rabbi says, that is so. Abraham himself lived during the period of the separation of the languages. He and his relatives retained the language of his grandfather Aver, which for that reason is called Hebrew. Avram's great-grandfather was Aver. And Rabbi Yudah Levi is saying in the Kuzri, Aver was called Aver because he was of the last generation that spoke Hebrew, the last generation that exclusively all people on the face of this earth spoke Hebrew. Avram is called Avram HaEvri because he is the one who comes from Aver, and he has taken over that Hebrew language from Aver. Of course, our rabbis give another reason why Avram is called Ivri, and which is Kol Ha'olam Kulo, the whole world is on one side, and Avram is Me Aver Ache, the other side. Very apt description of Avram Avinu, of course, a very apt description of the Jewish people today. It's the whole world on one side, and by the way, we're not paranoid. Was it that somebody that said, you know, even people who are paranoid have enemies, you know? We can be paranoid, and it can all be true. Kol ha'olam, the whole world is on one side, and he's on the other side. By the way, when in Torah is Avram referred to as Avram the Ivri, the Hebrew? When the person who flees from the field of battle comes to tell him that Lot has been captured by the four superpowers of the day. It's at that moment that Torah wants to point out to us that Avram feels very, very lonely. All of the powers of the day are arrayed against him. The fact that they took Lot captive is because they wanted to hurt Avraham. And he understands that he's on the whole world is on one side and he's on the other side. But Rav Yehuda Levi is going to give other reasons why he's called Ivri. But here it says because they spoke Hebrew. Now, he keeps saying he and his relatives retained the language of his grandfather Aver. Avram retained the language, which for that reason is called Hebrew. 400 years after him appeared Moses at a time when the world was rich in information concerning the heavens and the earth. When Moshe came to Egypt, he was not coming to some kind of a backward country. He wasn't coming to a place without intelligence and without great knowledge of what's happening in the world. And when he comes to these people, he approaches Pharaoh and the doctors of Egypt, as well as those of the Israelites. While agreeing with him, they questioned him. and completely refused to believe that God spoke with man until he caused them to hear the 10 words. The translation is so heavy. What he's really saying is the following. In the final analysis, by the Yam Suf, by the Red Sea, it says, Vayaminu b'Hashem, they believed in God over Moshe Avdo and in his servant Moshe. That means after 10 plagues, they still don't really believe him fully. It's after they've crossed to the other side of the sea that Torah finally tells us that they believed in Moshe. That does not stop them afterwards complaining against him and challenging him. And the only point at which they finally do indeed believe in Moshe is, as it says in Parshat Yitro, it says that God tells Moshe before revelation at Sinai, Hinini boy lecho ba'av ha'onam, I'm coming in the thick cloud to you, ba'avur yishma ha'om b'dabri imach, so that the people should hear as I speak to you, v'gam b'cho ya'aminu la'olam, and in you as well they will believe forever. The ultimate proof of the truth of Moshe, that he speaks the word of God and he transmits the word of God, is only when Jews see and hear themselves Moshe being spoken to by God. When they see that, then they finally believe in him. But all of the time in Mitzrayim, they didn't believe. They weren't convinced of him. And here comes the great statement. In the same way, the people were on his side, not from ignorance, but on account of the knowledge they possess. Bad translation. It means, yes, they heard what he said, but they didn't believe in him. They didn't trust him. They didn't trust him, and it's not because of their foolishness, but because of their wisdom. They feared magic and astrological arts and similar snares, things which, like deceit, do not bear close examination, whereas the divine might is like pure gold, ever increasing in brilliancy. They knew all sorts of wisdoms. They were very wary of people who came and said that they speak in the name of God. And they were right to do that. As we said, we're not a gullible people. It means that if finally it was proven to the Jewish people that Moshe Rabbeinu speaks the word of God, it means he must have been able to prove it beyond any shadow of a doubt. And that took place at Revelation at Mount Sinai. Yes. So then I ask you, why in Parshat Yitro, 4 parshiot after that, does it say, I'm coming in a cloud of glory to you, so that they should hear me speak to you, and then they will believe? There were different moments at which, yes, they believed, but it was not the kind of belief that would last throughout history. Mark, do you want to ask something? The 10 words are the ten commandments. The positive, Mark. I knoweth of what I speaketh. That's why I quoted, in order to explain the Kusri, I quoted the pasuk in Parshat Yitro by the 10 words. Is the 10 words? You know, 10 commandments. 10 commandments. Oh gosh. They have a little bit, you know, you're absolutely right. She said, but they only heard 2. These people attend so many shiurim. They know so much. It is so dangerous. You're absolutely right. The Gemara says that Onochi v'lo yielocho, the first 2 commandments were heard by the Jewish people, and the rest were transmitted to them by Moshe. So what, of course, Rabbi Yehuda Levi means here in the Kuzri is this scene at which the Ten Commandments were communicated to the Jewish people too directly and ate through Moshe that they finally believed in Moshe. Now watch. How could one imagine that an attempt had been made to show that a language spoken 500 years previously was none but Ava's own language split up in Bavel during the days of Peleg? Also to trace the origin of this or that nation back to Shem or Ham and the same of their country. When Torah gets down to very seemingly nitty-gritty details about ancient people, all of this serves to prove the truthfulness of Torah, because it's given at a time when everybody knows all of these people. You can't simply make statements that either cannot be proven or statements that are out and out lies. It would never wash. It would never be accepted. Incidentally, in our other shurim, in Chumash, we've been proving that a lot of these psukim that seem to be inconsequential information is no such thing in Torah. Every pasuk is of great import and tremendous consequence. All right, let's go a little further. Is it likely that anyone could today invent false statements concerning the origin, history, and languages of well-known nations? The latter being less than 500 years old, could we say that 500 years ago all languages came into being? So number 50, the king says this is not possible. How could it be, since we possess books in the handwriting of their authors written 500 years ago? No false interpolation could enter the contents of a book which is not above 500 years of age, such as genealogical tables, linguistic and other works. It had to be true. There was no way the Jews would have accepted it. If this would have been ridiculous, you would have had 3 million people at the foothills of Sinai laughing. The laugh heard round the world. The reason why this critical people accepted it is because they knew it to be true. They knew it to be true. All right. We did mention last week, I'm going to come to it now, that the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Chover, the Talmud Chacham, says to the king, do you know of any people on the face of this earth that have a structure of a week any different than the structure of one that starts on Sunday and ends on Shabbat? Is there an 8-day week? Is there a 6-day week? We're not talking about work weeks. The whole world, from beginning to end, divides the... It has a week that's made up of 7 days. How could this be? If it would have been brought to a committee, do you think that there would ever have been agreement on to what the week should look like? We'd still be fighting about it. So he says, obviously, because all men came from one man. Then he asks, have you ever heard of any system of mathematics or arithmetic that has more than 10 primary numbers? What would have happened if you would have given that over to a committee? To a committee. We would never have been able to add 2 and 2. Nothing. It would have all collapsed around us. The only reason why we have that is because obviously it came from one person created by God and endowed with the great wisdom of God. In number 57, did you ever hear of a nation which possessed different traditions with regard to the generally acknowledged week which begins with Sunday and ends with the Sabbath? How is it possible that the people of China could agree with those of the Western Islands without common beginning, agreement, and convention? It had to all start someplace, and someplace that everybody agreed to. The king says such a thing would only have been possible if they had all come to an agreement. This, however, is improbable unless all men are the descendants of Adam or Noah or of some other ancestor from whom they received the calculation. The calculation. So the rabbi says, all right, you know, I have you exactly where I want. That is what I meant. East and West agree on the decimal system. What instinct induced them to keep to the number 10 unless it was a tradition handed down by the first one who did so? And so now the chaver is going to tell him, but you should know. And it's amazing. He's talking about something that sounds ancient, but it's so contemporary. He says, what are you going to do about the books? There are books that were written by the people of India. And the people of India talk about times going back 20, 30, 40,000 years ago. What are you going to do with that? You tell me that the world is 4,500 years, that's what it was when the book was written, or the incidents that are supposed to have taken place in the book 4,500 years. But here are these people of India, the people of India who have all sorts of books that 20, 30, or let's turn it into 20 million, 20 billion years back. What do you do with that? So that was the question that the king asks in 60. And in 61, you may not like what he says at first, but you're going to have a little patience. The rabbi says it would indeed weaken my belief had they, the people of India, a fixed form of religion or a book concerning which a multitude of people held the same opinion and which no historical discrepancy could be found. Such a book, however, does not exist. You know what you have to do? You have to extrapolate from here. In other words, if you would have all scientists on the face of this earth agreed that the world started 20 billion years ago, not a day before, not a day after, then we'd have to sit up and take notice. But since there is no uniform opinion, there are so many different opinions, so it really means that they're groping. They don't have truth, they're groping. And we're going to see why the supposed age of the earth really does not concern us at all. This was some years ago, it was a big issue where they've proven that the world is this. We're totally unconcerned about that. We're unconcerned about it first of all, because the 6 days of creation, so what do you think? The world, when it was created by God, was one day old. And what do you think? You think when the world was created, there was no oil in Saudi Arabia? The day of its creation, there was oil in Saudi Arabia. Problem is, why there wasn't oil in Israel? So if you're going to, on the day that the earth is created, you're going to dig in Saudi Arabia and you're going to find oil. And then you're going to carbon test the oil. And the oil is 20 billion years old. Because God created a world fully grown and fully matured. And what do you think Adam and Eve wore on the day of creation? Were they little coochie-witchie bouncing little babies? Or were they people of full stature? In other words, the world was, in those 6 days in which it was created with all of the matter in it that could be tested to tell you 20 billion years. So it's really no problem. We also don't know to what extent the flood that came later, what effect it had on the face of this earth to have aged what have existed in the earth even more so. We also don't even know whether the 6 days of creation were 6 days of 24 hours. For 4 days of creation, there wasn't even sun and moon to differentiate in the 24 hours of a day. That only came to the fourth day. So that means each day of creation could have been billions of years. We're not concerned about it. The Medrash, there are many Medrashim that say, until this world came into being, God created worlds and destroyed them. The world that came into being may very well have contained the remains of so many previous worlds. I once saw Rav Soloveitchik said, what was the point? What was God's point in building worlds and destroying them? What do you think it is? This is he's playing with Lego, you know? He makes the world, gives it a destroy. Ice, start all over again. So the Chov once said the following idea. You know what God wanted to demonstrate to the world? A man's world can be destroyed and you can start all over again. A human being is endowed with the ability to start from scratch all over again. The purpose of the Medrash and the creation of worlds was to create within a human being, and certainly most specifically the Jewish people, the indomitable will never to despair and to keep going. So we're really not concerned. We're not concerned about all the books with the how old the world is, and though this is the great body blow to all of Torah and Judaism. Nonsense, absolutely nonsense. What Rabbi Yehuda Levi is saying over here is they don't even agree on anything, which means that we're not talking about something that has any sense of clarity to it. If it's not clear, I don't have to worry about it. Now, keep going. Apart from this, they are a dissolute, unreliable people and arouse the indignation of the followers of religions through their talk, while they anger them with their idols, talismans, and witchcraft. It can all also mean all sorts of so-called scientific theories. It's going to bring him ultimately to the point at which he's going to say that whatever you want to say about the creation of the world, the best that a scientist or a philosopher can say is a theory. There's no way to prove it. Nobody was around. Nobody was here. You can't prove it. You can't prove it. Watch. Yet they only possess a few books, and these were written to mislead the weak-minded. To this class belong the astrological writings in which they speak of tens of thousands of years. And one of the books that he mentions is the Nabataean agriculture, in which they are mentioned the names of Janbushar, Sagre, Dronai. It is believed that they lived before Adam, who was the disciple of Jan. You don't have to remember this, but you know, he just wants to point out that they're saying a lot of things that simply are not given to proof. They can't prove it, and therefore it shouldn't trouble us. So the king is going to say to him, this is important. The king is going to say to him, okay, so you tell me that the people of India are a people you can't depend on. What about the philosophers, the Aristotles, the Platos? They're the ones who disagree with Judaism. What are you going to do with them? You can't simply say, well, they're an unreliable people. Don't take them seriously. Watch. 63. There's an excuse for the philosophers. He's going to elaborate here on an idea that we had expressed earlier. And that is, the philosophers came from Greece. He's going to make a point that's really fascinating. Why is it, and I think in the first shiur we already alluded to this, why is it that since that period in time when there were Greek philosophers, there haven't been any Greek philosophers since then? Where did all the wisdom go? I think we used, since Aristotle and Plato, we've only had Anthony Quinn. And then somebody has to tell me that Anthony Quinn wasn't, he may have played Zorba the Greek, but he wasn't born in Greece. what happened to a brilliant people that produced such minds that the world still studies them? And then after that, it was all gone. All gone. Jews have been able to produce great people generation after generation. Great minds. Greece is nothing now for 2,500 years. Can't say it too loud. I mean, but everybody knows the truth. Everybody knows the truth. What happened to that period of great wisdom of Greece? See, he says that great period of wisdom was the result of the fact that Greece had been conquered by Persia. Greece conquered Persia. There was, after the destruction of the first Beth HaMikdash, there was the Babylonian exile. Babylon fell before the forces of Persia. And then Alexander the Great. And there came, Greece finally came in contact with Persia and Babylon. He's going to say, where did Babylonian and Persian wisdom come from? It came from the Jews who had been exiled to Babylon. And from there it went, from Jews to Babylonians, from Babylonians to Persians, from Persians to Greeks. And that created the great period of Greek philosophy. When Rome conquered Greece, Greece already no longer had any kind of contact, significant contact with the peoples of the world. It was all over. Greek philosophy came to an end. There were no great Greeks after that. Simply there weren't. We know that as a historical fact, and it's an amazing historical fact. What was it about the Jews that was different? We had a Masorah, we had a tradition. We were related directly back to Adam, to Avraham, to Noah, and to Adam. And he says the big difference that it made is with regard to the question of, did the world always exist or was it brought into being by an act of creation? That's the important question. Was it brought into being by an act of God's will or was the world always around? Aristotle took the position that the world was always around. And therefore, according to Aristotle, there's no such thing as God's will in any way. There could be a God, there couldn't be a God. But he certainly does not impact on the world. Plato's approach was a bit different. Plato's approach was that, yes, the world began with some kind of primeval matter. Not that the world was always here, but there was certain matter that existed in the world. And as far as Plato is concerned, there is place for one to believe that God acted, God who was here all the time, acted on that primeval matter and he made a world out of it. We can live with Plato, we can explain Torah according to Plato, we have difficulty explaining, we can't explain it according to Aristotle. So, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes a comment that really is going to be repeated afterwards by the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim, and it's going to come up in the 13th century. I want to read a paragraph from Isidore Epstein. Interesting in this connection is the remark of A.E. Taylor. You know, he quotes all these Englishmen. We don't have English tradition. You know, we know the American philosophers and writers. Anyway, he quotes A.E. Taylor that Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas, had caused something of a scandal in the 13th century by maintaining that it is impossible to prove by reason alone that the world had a beginning in time. Aquinas said, you can't prove, nobody can prove that the world came into being at a particular moment in time. You also can't prove that it was always here. And why did they get shook up with Aquinas? Because if you can't prove by reason alone that the world had a beginning in time, that would seem to question the whole story of creation. You see, he says about Taylor, evidently Taylor who quotes Aquinas and says that Aquinas, it was come out like heresy, that you can't prove that the world had a beginning in time. You can't prove Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim et haaretz. So Taylor says this statement of Aquinas, wow, it shook everybody up. So he says, evidently he did not know that here too, as in other things, Aquinas took over from Maimonides. He's in fact quoting the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim, who devotes a considerable part of the second book of his guide to this theme. Although it might be mentioned that in this, Maimonides had already been anticipated by Yehuda HaLevi. What Yehuda HaLevi is going to say now is going to find much greater expression. What Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi takes care of in a few sentences, the Rambam is going to devote about 20 chapters in the Guide for the Perplexed. And in the 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas, I went to a Catholic college, Loyola. And one of the things that we did, you understand, we didn't have joke books under the table, but we did find all sorts of things that St. Thomas Aquinas said that were just lifted directly out of the Rambam. We don't know whether Yehuda HaLevi as well, or one may, he over here, Isidore Epstein, has said this, when he said, evidently he did not know that here too, as in other things, Aquinas took over from Maimonides. He didn't even say he took from Maimonides. What Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say, and he quotes Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, we're going to get to it in a moment. The question of eternity and creation, was the world always here, or was it brought into being by an act of creation, is baffling, and the arguments on both sides are evenly balanced. You can argue for creation, Bereshis, and you can argue for eternity of the world. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say, this is the dilemma that faced the Greek philosophers, and the only thing that inclined them toward eternity was because they didn't have a tradition. If they would have had the historical tradition that we had going all the way to Adam HaRishon, they would immediately have made the decision in favor of creation of the world. Because this is an issue that simply can't be decided one way or another. By reason, it can't be decided one way or another. There are things in this world, things of the spirit, where logic and the rational mind simply has to bow before religion and say, well, there is something more than the here and now and the and the physical world that can be proven or disproven. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say that the Greeks simply didn't have Mesorah. They didn't have a tradition. Would they have had a tradition, they would have chosen creation over the eternity world. Did we quote last week that article that you may have missed in the Jerusalem Post? There was a fellow who wrote an article, Hanukkah Time. He said, if you take, what's Greece in Hebrew? Yavan, Yud, Vav, Nun. Put a tzaddik in front of it, and you know what it becomes? Tzion. What Yavan was missing was Torah mitzion. What Yavan was missing, they didn't have the tradition. they didn't have tzaddikim amongst them who had carried the traditional. Isn't that a beautiful word from the Jerusalem Post? It was section 2. First sheet that I gave you today. One of the great poems of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And there's one great line, but I'll give you the lines around it. It directly relates to what he's saying here. You see what's underlined? V'al tashiacho chokmat yivanit. If you really want to impress your friends and neighbors, just learn this in Hebrew and you'll wow them. V'al tashiacho chokmat yivanit. Do not be seduced by Greek wisdom. Asher ein lo pri. It has no fruit. Ki im prachim. Only flowers. It's beautiful. Greek wisdom is beautiful. It has flowers, but there's no fruit. There's at the core, there's nothing there. What a beautiful sentence. Al tashiach chokmat yivonit. Don't be seduced by Greek wisdom. Asher ein lo pri ki im prachim, that has no fruit but flowers. Now watch, another few lines over here. Upirya, the fruit that it does have, is ki adama lo rikua. It's like earth that hasn't been dug through. Vichilo ole shachak metuchim, and there are no tents of heaven spread over it. It's a fruit without life to it. Now watch. Look at what the man says. Therefore, because it's not real wisdom, because its fruit is dead, therefore, ein reishit, l'chol ma'aseh bereishit, therefore, they believe that there's no beginning to all of creation. It's gorgeous. Ve'ein achrit l'chidush ha'yirachim. They see no end, like the world is going to keep going on forever and ever, ever and after. There is no end to the renewal of the months. Shema divrei nivoneha. Hear the words of her wise men, nivuchim, confused. Isn't that what he was saying over here? They don't all agree on any one idea. There is so much difference of opinion. There's confusion amongst them. Benuyim, and whatever they do right is built a yisod tohu, on a foundation of nothingness, fetuchim, and spread out. And you know what's going to happen to you? You're going to study Greek wisdom, v'toshuv l'cha, you will return from it, b'lev reikam, with a heart that's empty, v'no'ur. And no'ur also means like to have been emptied out, shaken out. Umpemole, but you can have a mouth that's full. Berov sigim v'sichim, you can be able to quote all sorts of very, very fine sentences. But you know what it all is? It's all a lot of talk. It's all flower and no fruit. V'lomoze. Avakesh li orachot. This is the end of his poem. V'lomoze avakesh li orachot. Why do I have to look for those paths? Atal kalot. They're crooked ones. What do I have to do it for? Ve'ezov aim orchim. I should forsake the mother of all paths. I have Torah. Why should I leave that? For the confusion, which is Greek wisdom, and ultimately is empty. Al tashiacho chochmas yevonis asher ein lo pri ki imprachim. What a sentence. Good, I got that. Got that taken out of it. One of the great, there are many, many great lines in Yehuda Halevi. I chose, of course, this one because this clearly is the poetic expression of all the ideas that he's saying right here. All right. Oh no, we still have time. Okay. So tell you, let's finish that 63 and 65, you'll see. He's talking about the Greeks, and he say they belong to the descendants of Japhet, who inhabited the north, while that knowledge coming from Adam, the knowledge of the world coming from Adam and supported by the divine influence, is only to be found among the progeny of Shem, who represented the successors of Noach and constituted, as it were, his essence. We and the people of Shem were the essence of Adam and Noach. This knowledge has always been connected with this essence and will always remain so. The Greeks only received it when they became powerful from Persia. The Persians had it from the Chaldeans. Those are the Babylonians. It was only then that the famous Greek philosophers arose, but as soon as Rome assumed political leadership, they produced no philosopher worthy of the name. It's a fact. It's a historical fact. So the king asked him, does this mean that Aristotle's philosophy is not deserving of credence? I mean, we have to be able to judge Aristotle on the basis of what he said. We can't simply say that they were a people who had no wisdom before and no wisdom afterward. So he says, certainly he exerted his mind because he had no tradition from any reliable source at his disposal. He meditated on the beginning and the end of the world, but found as much difficulty in the theory of a beginning as in that of eternity. He saw both sides were equal to him. Logically, he could arrive at either a decision that the world was always here, eternity, or he could arrive at a decision that the world had come into being as an act of creation. Finally, these abstract speculations which made for eternity that the world was always here prevailed, and he found no reason to inquire into the chronology or derivation of those who lived before him. He didn't ask for history. If he would have gone back to look at history, as one of our leaders here says, history bores me. Understand? History bores me. When you're bored with history, you're going to repeat the mistakes of history. That's what's happening over here. Had he lived among a people with well-authenticated and generally acknowledged traditions, he would have applied his deductions and arguments to establish the theory of creation. He would have used all of his great genius to prove that there was creation, however difficult it may be, instead of eternity, which is even more difficult to accept. In his final statement, Rebbe Halevi is saying, they're not equally balanced, logically, or by reason. It's not equal that the eternity of the world or creation. No. Fact is that creation solves more problems than eternity raises. But v'al tashiacha, very important, come on. Is there any decisive proof? He asks, the king asks, is there any decisive proof one way or another, creation or eternity? Says, where could we find one for such a question? How can we find proof for such a question? And heaven forbid that there should be anything in the Bible to contradict that which is manifest or proved. You can't say that Torah wrote something that absolutely defies reason and logic. And that's why this is a question for which there is no proof. On the other hand, it tells of miracles and the changes of ordinary things newly arising or changing one into another. This proves that the creator of the world is able to accomplish what he will and whenever, wherever he will. What's the difference between believing in a world that was always here and a world that was brought into being as an act of will? The big difference is, does God intervene in this world? Is nature his doing, and therefore he can alter nature at any point in time? According to Aristotle, that was impossible. According to Plato, there still remained the possibility that God can act in the world. Because somebody or some force or some power had to act on that primeval matter from which the world came. The question of eternity and creation is obscure, while the arguments are evenly balanced. The theory of creation derives greater weight from the prophetic tradition of Adam, Noah, and Moshe, which is more deserving of credence than mere speculation. If it's a question of my own speculation or accepting the tradition of Moshe, Adam, and Noah, that's what we go for. If, after all, a believer in the law finds himself compelled to admit an eternal matter, now he's referring to Plato. If a believer, if we would be in the position that somebody would prove to us beyond any shadow of a doubt that there was eternal matter from which the world came into being, and the existence of many worlds prior to this one, if somebody was able to prove that to us, this would not impair his belief. It would not shake us at all. It wouldn't upset us. We wouldn't be caught, never, you proved that there were many worlds before this. Our rabbis told us about it. That this was world. It would not in any way, it would not in any way contradict the belief that this world was created at a certain epoch and that Adam and Noah were the first human beings. Now, I gave you some sheets over here. I have to refer to some of them because they, you know, maybe we'll stop. There's so much to do over here. Let's start with the English one. Yeah. And this one, because especially since I find over here a quote that I told you last week, and here we have the quote in full. If you'll take a look at footnote number 10, Nicholas Berdayev, The Meaning of History, and also Bachi Mkudel Chovet Halavavot, this Nicholas Berdayev wrote, and Chovet Halavavot wrote, if anyone seeks evidence at the present for the wonders of the Exodus and for the Sinaitic revelation, let him look with candid eyes at our position amongst the nations. If you're looking for miracles, you know where you're going to find miracles? Just take a look at Jewish history. Take a look. Look at what we've been through. And we're still here. Let him look at with candid eyes at our position among the nations since the exile began and our settled condition in their midst, notwithstanding that we do not agree with them in belief and practice, of which disagreement they are aware. They know that we're different. They know that we're different. This is even as our Creator promised us, and yet for all that, when you are on the land of your enemies, I will not reject them, neither will I abhor them utterly to destroy them, to break my covenant with them. If it had not been for the Lord who was for us, let Israel say now, when men rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us up alive. David HaMelech says in Tehillim, if not for the fact that God's with us, we would have been swallowed up a long, long time ago. Eloquent, too, are the words of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And I told it to you in brief last week. Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, we are the exiled nation, the scattered sheep. After all the troubles and vicissitudes we have passed through during thousands of years, nor is there any nation in the world which is being persecuted as we are. Hey, and he lived before the Shoah. And he lived before 2004. How many have been our oppressors? How mighty those who rose against us from our youth in order to destroy and uproot us. To the utmost have they afflicted us because of their hatred, of which jealousy is the cause, yet they have not prevailed against us. Of all ancient and mighty nations, the memory is lost, their expectations gone, their shadows departed, but we cleave unto the eternal. All are alive to this day. Egypt enslaved thee, Babylon crushed thee, Rome led thee captive, homeless thy head. Where are those nations, mighty and fearsome? Thou hast survived them. They are long dead. Nations keep coming, nations keep going, passing like shadows, wiped off the earth. Thou an eternal witness remainest, bearing a message. God is but one. Did I impress you? Huh? No, that I didn't learn in my Catholic college. I once told the story of that poem. It's a poem called Israel, my people, God's greatest. Israel, my people, God's greatest riddle. Will thy solution ever be told? And then, you know, those nations keep coming, nations keep going. Babylon, Egypt enslaved thee. Babylon crushed thee. Nations keep coming. When I graduated elementary school, Torah V'Das, so there was a, they had at the graduation a declamation contest. And I was one of those who was chosen to be the finalist. Now, of course, I had very, very heavy competition. Because the only other person who was going to recite a poem was going to recite Casey at the Bat. Now, do you think Casey at the Bat stood a chance against Israel, my people? All right. Anyway, I did have one problem. The graduation when I was on a Sunday night, and that Friday I had a minor accident and my finger got all caught and something cut, and I had a big bandage on my finger. Now, I was planning at the graduation, you know, nations keep coming, nations keep going. But then I said, God, I'm going to stand up there with my big... So the whole Shabbos, you know, nations keep coming, nations keep going. Yeah. I couldn't help myself. Nations keep on. That's what Rav Yaakov Emden is saying. In other words, that poem is the expression of what Rav Yaakov Emden is saying. The very survival of the Jewish people is the greatest proof. It's the greatest proof that we are the people of God. I mean, I said this 1,000 times over. I always say, I don't need any lectures anymore to prove the existence of God or the Torah is true. 5.3 million Jews living in Eretz Israel in the year 2004 are the greatest proof of the fulfillment of prophecies that were said 2,500 years ago by Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. The greatest proof of Torah that was given at Sinai that says, V'shav Hashem Elokecha et Shvutcha, God is going to return your captivity. Unbelievable. We are the living proof that Torah and prophecy is absolutely true. Let me just finish Reb Yaakov Emden. And then he says, of all ancient and mighty nations, boy, that poem came in handy. I didn't think of it. Of all ancient and mighty nations, the memory is lost, their expectations gone, their shadow departed, but we who cleave unto the eternal are all alive to this day. What can the sharp-witted philosopher say to this? This is Rabbi Yaakov Emden, 300 years ago. Has the hand of chance wrought all this? By my life, he swears, Chai Hashem. In Hebrew he says, I swear to God. When I reflect on all these wonders, they appear to me greater than all the miracles and wondrous acts which God performed for our ancestors in Egypt and in the wilderness and in the land of Israel. The longer the exile lasts, the more confirmed does this miracle become and all the acts of his power and might. So it's not only tradition, we are also part of that tradition. Greece didn't have the tradition. They didn't have the tradition, so therefore there may have been great wisdom, but even that great wisdom of Greece itself was at its very core hollow, empty, nothing there, and it would disappear. So you have a lot of stuff to quote. And I'm afraid to say we haven't even scratched the surface of the Kuzari yet, but we're getting there. We're getting closer and closer every week. Okay.